wondering if the Rob can tell us. Very recently, the Open Orthodox Movement has an institution called the Shivat Maharit, which is ordaining female Jewish clergy.
Maharat.
Yeah. I was wondering if Rob could comment about that and just tell us a little bit about Rabbis and how they fit into Torah Hashkafa.
Well, you know, it's a complicated issue because the flagship institution, although Maharat is officially independent, but it's all the same institution, is Chovei Torah, YCT as they call it. And Yeshiva Chovei Torah was started probably 15 years ago in order to create a more modern type of rabbi, a rabbi that could relate better to different types of Jews. And they were very big on Avas Yisrael and on Midos, Min Adam L'Chaveiro, and they also felt that Rabbanim should get not only Halacha Shiurim, but they should also get counseling and how to deal with people. And all of that is very, very good, actually. In other words, there was room for that. It was a more compassionate type of leadership. But many communities are modern communities, and many communities are not places where people want to become more Haredi or Yeshivish, but they do want to become more observant, so there is a place for them too, right? So in principle, this was good. Now what happened was that it really became a Chorban. It became a Chorban in the sense that the modernization became so overwhelming that it kind of drowns out the Orthodoxy. So for example, some rabbis of Chovei Torah, when the Supreme Court... we didn't talk about it when 2 weeks ago in the United States legitimated gay marriage, single-sex marriage. All right, it's a big tragedy. The Gemara in Chulin says that Sodom was not destroyed because they practiced homosexuality. Sodom was destroyed because they wrote a ksuva for homosexuality, meaning to say it's much worse than the Avera itself. Okay, so but Seder. So it's one thing to say I'm going to keep quiet, I'm not going to fight because no one's going to listen to me, and I have to save my energy. But they have rabbis who came out with editorials saying this was a good thing, gevaldik. They quoted the pasuk Rachman al Islam, lo tov hayais adam levada. It's not good for man to be alone. You know, the Torah wants this. You know, so at this point, and then another person who's their most learned person, the only person who got smicha yadin yadin, the highest smicha, wrote an article that the avos are really myths. There never was an Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, but they're important and they teach us lessons. And, you know, whatever it is, they have crossed the line into kafir. Not everybody. In fact, last week, I met a person who actually learned in Or Sameach 15 years ago. And he has smicha from YCT. And he's just a regular, mainstream, good hospital chaplain who teaches medical halacha and, you know, perfectly fine. So I don't want to say every single person, God forbid, it's not true. But the institution has crossed over into Kfira, and among their many other auxiliary activities is the ordination of women. The first one was called Rabba, not Rabbi, Rabba, as if that's going to make a difference. I always thought Rabba was the Amori and the Gemara, but okay. That's better than Rabbi. Rabbi is nothing. Rabba, that's one will be Abaya, one will be Rabba, Rabba. And then he switched it to Maharat, and then they're going back now to Rabbi eventually. Now, what is so bad about that, though, intrinsically? Intrinsically, the argument has been made, well, a woman cannot do certain things. A woman cannot count for a minyan. A woman cannot daven for the omud, right? A woman cannot be kosher liatis. But a woman, theoretically, if she knows more than a man, is able to paskin a shayla. Proof is, in a number of kolo houses, that's actually the case. The woman knows the halacha, the man who learns Gemara doesn't know the halacha. Shouldn't be that way, but it is that way. So the argument goes, what's wrong with giving a woman a title if she's learned and if she knows things? But the truth of the matter is, intrinsically, it is not the worst thing in the world. But there's a track record here that this will lead to, one thing leads to another thing. That from women rabbis, you're going to get women bale kore, which is absolutely usher. From women rabbis, you're going to get a woman counting for a minyan, because after all, what sense does it make for a shul, let's say, to say, we'll hire a woman rabbi, but we don't count her for a minyan? Well, what type of rabbi doesn't get counted for a minyan? So they're going to say, you mean I can be the head of this congregation, but I can't be in a minyan? So people are going to say, well, I guess you're right. I guess we have to make you a minyan. You know, one thing is going to lead to another thing, to another thing, to another thing, to another thing. And if the Messiah of Klal Yisrael for thousands of years, really from the beginning, has been not to have this. And people want to create new things. Well, what's going to happen? I mean, what's going to happen? Meaning, even if a new thing is not the worst thing, be etzem, it is poreitz geder. And poreitz geder, again, this may sound like a fanatical response, but the truth of the matter is, it's a reality that when people start making these types of changes, there is no end. And this is not just a theoretical idea. This yeshiva, if you want to call it a yeshiva, has demonstrated that they will go from one thing to the other thing. From, in other words, they started off saying that if somebody is homosexual, we shouldn't embarrass them, we shouldn't shame them, we shouldn't exclude them from coming to shul, we should give them chizuk. I agree with that. I would not be in favor of ever embarrassing somebody, Barabbin. People do averus. Okay, we all have averus, they have averus. Okay, so they started off with a good thing. It was a little radical because no other organization said it. But what does it lead to? Gay marriage, the greatest day. Somebody wrote that this is like the struggle of the Hashmonaim against Greek oppression. And therefore you have to celebrate it like Hanukkah. What type of... This is, as the Pasuk says, they call Or Choshech and Choshech Or. So there is a track record here that these little changes turn into, which on them in themselves are not the worst thing in the world. They turn into horrendous, horrendous reforms. Open Orthodoxy is much less religious than the conservative movement was when it started. In fact, the Reform movement wasn't so bad. What was the first thing the Reform movement did? They said that from now on the rabbi will give the drasha in German instead of Yiddish. In fact, in Poland never had the Reform movement. So in Krakow, Poland, all the shuls are still there because the Nazis did not destroy the Krakow shuls because of the architecture. They killed all the Jews, but they left the buildings up. So if you go to Krakow, Poland, you can see beautiful shuls. But the Ramaz shul, you know, that's the most important one. But there's one beautiful, beautiful building that was called the Temple. This was the Reform Synagogue of Krakow. What was the Reform Synagogue of Krakow? So you go in, there's a mechitza, there's like a shas, you know. What makes it a Reform Synagogue? Says, oh, that's where they gave the drasha in Polish instead of Yiddish. Now, I mean, every non-Hasidic shul in America gives a drasha in English today. But what happened was, by starting with those changes, you eventually became kavira. So the Marat thing is a real, real big problem. I mean, I know Maharats. I've spoken to Maharats. I mean, they're not monsters, and some of them are very, very fine people. They're people. Some of their kavanas are l'shem shemayim, but as part of this institutional structure, it is creating a great, great priestess. And this is besides tzinius and literal sexual priestess. But besides that, it's a priestess in the integrity of Messiah. And when you have any movement that says the way Klal Yisrael has been doing things for thousands of years is not right, it's a mistake, it's time to change, you're going to have all sorts of chesroinus. So it's not a good thing. Now what's going to happen is that Open Orthodoxy is going to become right-wing conservatism, for sure, and it may even become left-wing conservatism, and I think the movement is going to disappear as an Orthodox movement within a decade or so.
This sort of branches off maybe to the previous question. When controversies or whatnot happen in the Orthodox world that are mayors or whatnot, unfortunately, how do we approach it maybe when discussing it with either non-from Jews or non-Jews, in the sense that in one way we want to say that that's not reflective of Judaism, but, yeah. But also kind of... since the fact they are Jews, still Donald Tuskos and whatnot, and still say, you know, they are Jews, and we can't, like, how do we balance that when there's controversy?
Are you referring to controversies coming from the from world or from
right.
the non-from
right.
world?
From the
in other words, when the from world does stupid things, like knock, right. punch a woman off a bus or something, right. how do you defend it? Yeah. So one thing is this. I'm a little different than I think some people. Some people have this idea that you have an absolute chiv to justify whatever religious Jews do, no matter what. That no matter what somebody says, yeah, they had a right to throw the woman off the bus because her sleeves went above her elbow, and therefore we threw her off the bus. And, you know, and there are people, you know, my country right or wrong, so to speak, meaning from you did it, they're right. Now, the truth of the matter is, number one, that's not even true, because people do things that are wrong. But number two, it's also counterproductive, because when you take that type of position, the other side is just going to think you're crazy. You've lost your credibility. You've lost your ability to convey any view about Torah Judaism. So it's both this idea of unconditional defense is both false, and it is also counterproductive in terms of communicating to somebody what Judaism is like. So what you have to do is, you have to be what we call a modeh b'miktzas, right? You're familiar with modeh b'miktzas? If I ask you for $100 and you're modeh 50, that's called modeh b'miktzas. Modeh b'miktzas means you see the legitimacy of the attacking side. You say, you know, you're right, this was not a good thing, and this is something that, you know, Gedolim are against. In other words, they have to feel that you respect what they're saying, you understand their tightness, and this is not, I'm not just saying this as a fake, I'm saying genuinely. And then, when you soften somebody up and they understand that they're being heard, you can then present the other side of the coin. So let's say, for example, how would you deal with the idea of, in Ramat Beit Shemesh, when there were school children that were not dressed sunnias, so there were Haredi Jews that spat on them. Right? Awful thing. So you have to say it's awful, 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 not good. Gedolim don't approve of it. It's a chilul Hashem. But then you say, but at the same time, you do have to understand the mindsets of people that are trying to create a certain type of environment for their families. And it's so important for them that there not be these negative influences. So they overreact. Don't say that they're right. But say they overreact because it's so important to them that sometimes people do things that are not right because they think it's the only way they can protect their children. Do you see the difference? In other words, instead of saying, yeah, the girls, you know, got what they deserved, you actually admit to the other side that they're right, but then you explain that when people care very deeply about their religious values, they sometimes overreact. If, God forbid, your child was about to be killed, you might go crazy. You might go crazy. Well, they go crazy because for them, this type of negative environment is potentially killing their children. So it's a great, great chokhmah in talking to non-religious Jews or even more modern Jews that you don't dismiss what they're saying. You accept what they're saying, but then you try to show them another side and another perspective. You know, Rav Shvadron, the great Maggid of Yerushalayim, used to give a mashal to this, a very, very nice, actually it wasn't a mashal, it was an actual story in his life, but he would use it as a mashal. He said that once he was walking in Shari Chesed, where he lived, and a kid was riding a bike, and whatever it is, the bike went over a stone or a rock, and the child fell off, he flew off the bike like a six-year-old, and he banged his head on the ground, and his forehead was bleeding, in a very big gash. So Rav Shvadron took the boy in his arms, because the boy was almost unconscious, and he was running up the hill to go to Kupat Cholim or go to a doctor. So there was an old woman that he knew on the Merpeset, and she saw him running with this child, very agitated, and she said, Reb Shalom, don't worry, everything will be alright, don't worry, everything will be alright, the Eibishter will help. But then as he's running in her direction, she sees it's her grandson, Meir, who fell off the bicycle. So all of a sudden she starts shrieking, America, America, Eves, Mir. Okay, Baruch Hashem, the child was okay. But Rav Shalom asked her later, you know, how come when you didn't know who it was, everything will be okay, don't worry, everything will be fine. As soon as it's your grandchild, all of a sudden you go crazy and you're worried and you're scared. The Chayra was the same accident. You saw the accident. The answer is, when it's yours, you care a lot more. So Rav Shadron said that things like Shabbos, Kashrus, Sneas, Taras HaMishpacha, this is like our grandchild. These are our children, our grandchildren. So we feel more strongly. We feel more strongly. So that's how you explain it. But at the same time, you got to denounce it as well, because it is a Chilul Hashem, and it really destroys the cause of Torah. It does not advance it. So I think when you have a modeh b'miktzas approach in these interactions, you will be much more successful and persuasive than simply saying, Haredim, right or wrong, you know, whatever it is, instead of that kind of super patriotic attitude. Same thing with the army. People will tell you, you know, why don't, you know, B'nai Torah fight in the army? So you have to say, because it is true. You know, we are very grateful to the people who fight in the army, and this is Emes. This is not a lot. I'm not saying this for public relations. We are grateful, and they serve a valuable, necessary function in the world that we live in, because we live in a world of hishtadlus, where we have to have an army. We can't just daven and learn. We're not on that madrega. But at the same time, you also have to understand that the ultimate success of Am Yisrael does depend on Hashem helping us, because b'derech hateva, we have no way, even with the best army, of defeating the millions and millions and millions of hostile people that surround us. And we believe that Hashem helps Am Yisrael when there's Torah and mitzvahs. Right, so you kind of show them both sides. You know, the word shalom means peace, and shalem means wholeness. And the Mefarshim say, when you see both sides of the story, when you see the whole side of the story, then there's shalom. Shalom is where instead of saying, this is it, and the other side says, this is it, well, all you're going to have are standoffs. This is it. No, this is it. Well, that's not going to get you anywhere. But if you can see the other person's side, then they will see your side as well, and then there can be a shalom. Yeah, did you, in the back? Yeah.
Yeah, right. My question is, when you go out in the streets, yeah, and you go to the park, and you see that religious people are polluting the land, the ground, can you go to them and say to them, you know, this is the holy land, you should not pollute it? Mm. Or when you see, when you go in the street, you see like religious people have a can or something, and throw it in the street like it's, I don't know, like the street is a... It's a garbage bag.
Yes, yeah. See, here we have the first Haredi environmentalist. This is very good. not the first, but one of the early ones. Baruch Hashem.
Because in Europe we don't have this.
It's cleaner, yeah. I know.
Like, if it would be a not religious guy, okay, yeah. I don't know, but this is for me like a big Baruch Hashem, because not religious, see, the religious people, how they pollute the air, the land.
Yeah.
For me, the religious people, okay, this,
yeah.
I don't know.
You are actually 100% right. Generally speaking, to throw garbage in any street, even in America, you know, not only in Israel, is considered to be stealing from the Rishus HaRabim, because the streets are public property, and you are taking away people's enjoyments, or, you know, reducing people's enjoyment and pleasure in the street. So it's considered to be a form of gezel. And in Eretz Yisrael in particular, it's a bigger aveira, because the Ramban says that part of the mitzvah of yishuv Eretz Yisrael, living in Eretz Yisrael, is not just living here, but beautifying it and making it nice. And therefore, every time you pick up a piece of garbage, if you do that, you are fulfilling an inyan of yishuv. You're making it more miyushav. You're making it more settled, more beautiful. So really, in reality, a Jew should not pollute or litter, even in Chutz Laretz, and certainly in Eretz Yisrael. Why, you may wonder, so why did it become such a phenomenon that people throw so much garbage around? Like, why should that be so? You know, you go to Tzfat sometimes, and you have beautiful, breathtaking, you know, sunsets and the mountains. And then you look down at your feet, and you just have like piles of garbage. You know, even in Sfat, you know, what happened? How could this be? How could one take the land that Hashem gave us, the holy lands, and corrupt it? Would somebody throw garbage in the Beis HaMikdash? I really hope not, but you know, who knows? But in the Beis HaMikdash itself. So how did this happen is a very good question. I really don't know. I mean, the only thing I could say is that when people are poor and they live in very crowded conditions, there's just not a lot of room. So they get into the habit of throwing things out because they don't have a lot to put it. Or maybe there's not enough trash receptacles, especially Erev Shabbos, where, you know, things get real full and overflowing, and, you know, What do you do? So you're 100% correct. People need to be sensitive. Somebody told me a Shrekuch story. It's really a crazy story. That some people use a park on Shabbos. They're somech on different Eruvin, and they use a park to have picnics. No, religious families. But they leave the garbage on the table because they say it's muktzah on Shabbos. We're not allowed to throw it away. We can't move. Sorry. Well, you know, Laniya Staiti, I don't think it's a very big Kiddush here, but if you're going to take the very strict position, in which you don't even, there are many positions to be made of, that I'm not allowed to throw away my garbage on Shabbos, then you don't have your picnic on Shabbos in the park. And you don't say, I'm going to have a picnic, but never, I can't throw away my garbage. You know, what type of cheshmin is that? Now, your question is, should I go over to somebody and give them tochacha? That's a tough question. You know, Chazal do have a very important rule that it's better that somebody be a shogeg, somebody be accidental, than be on purpose. And if it's likely they're not going to listen to you, they're not going to pay attention to you, then it's usually better not to say. I think that's usually going to be the case here. So somebody even asked the great Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Akiva, how come nobody takes tochacha today? I give people tochacha and nobody listens. Rabbi Akiva said, it's because nobody knows how to give tochacha. It's a very, very difficult art to know how to give somebody mussar in a way that they'll be makabel. Most people, when they get mussar, they get resentful, they get angry, and they don't want to listen. And maybe lahachish, just to show that you can't tell them what to do, they'll take out something from their pocket and throw it down extra, you know. So, as a usual policy, it's better not to say, but you're correct. It's very, very disturbing, and that we should be machshev the environment. This is part of the gift Hashem gave us, and if you appreciate what Hashem gives you, you want to treat it in a good way.
Okay. In terms of the Torah idea of chesed and becoming a giver as opposed to a taker, it's obviously of central importance, and it's one of our main goals throughout life. So I'm wondering how that fits in with learning Torah full time, especially if you don't think you're going to ever be a rabbi and you're really just, but you want to shag all day, because that's also the highest thing.
Yes. Well, again, these are very, very difficult balances, but let me just point out a very obvious thing. If you get married, right, and you want to be a giver instead of a taker, remember what the Gemara says. The main olam haba that a wife earns is that she helps her husband learn. So in effect, you are giving the best thing you can to your wife by learning. You're giving her olam haba, right? So you're not just taking, you are giving. And you're giving her the chance to do so many great, great mitzvahs. But having said that, it is very, very true that even a ben Torah, even a person that is a rabbi or is a Talmud Chacham or whatever it is, has to be committed to helping their wives, to spending time with their children, to doing chesed in the house, unless the wife really doesn't need it. And if you're fortunate enough to have a wife who doesn't need you to do that kind of thing. Again, Rabbi Yashar's Rebbetzin wouldn't let him do anything. In fact, 2 weeks before Pesach, she would kick him out of the house because she didn't want the Pesach cleaning to disturb him, so she would rent a hotel room and he would spend 2 weeks there. But, if you have that type of shidduch, and it can happen, less so in modern times, but, you know, it can happen, what you give to your wife is your gratitude and your appreciation. The worst thing is to be a beneficiary of what your wife is doing and not even appreciate it. And when there's Hakara Satov is what you give somebody. In other words, if I show you that I'm grateful for what you're doing, that is giving, that is not taking. You're giving gratitude. And that is most appreciated of all, right? You're showing your wife that she's important to you, that you need her, right? So I guess my point is, giving can take different ways. Your learning is a form of giving. The time that you spend in chesed for your family is a form of giving. And even appreciation and gratitude is a form of giving. I should say too, again, I mean, you guys are not married yet, but, you know, Mirza Hashem, you have to try to make your wife a little bit of part of your world. You're in kollel, you're in yeshiva, you're doing different things. And, you know, wife might be working or taking care of the children or whatever it is. And she really doesn't know a lot of what you're doing. She really, really doesn't know. You know, she knows you're learning, but she does. She may not even know what that is, depending on her background. But even if you went to seminary, she doesn't necessarily know what Gemara is like. So when something interesting happens or something good happens, you need to tell her. Now, and even I'm not suggesting you actually learn Taisus or Ramban with your wife in Gemara. Although, depending on the wife, maybe, yeah, because it is mutual between husband and wife, even to learn Gemara. But you at least say, you know, wow, we had a very interesting Shaila the Gemara talks about. What do you think? Just a conversation. So you should involve her in your world a little bit so that she knows what you're doing, and therefore she can feel that she's really, really contributing to the process because she understands what you're doing. So these are different forms of giving. Giving does not mean you have to spend, you know, 14 hours a day with your wife. Now, sometimes guys who get married, they ask me, I mean, some things can't be quantified. So, how many minutes am I supposed to talk to my wife a day? I can't answer those types of questions. But as I say, you know, my wife has a saying that she heard from somebody else, but it's a really, really great saying. She says, if you give me a half an hour, I'll only take 5 minutes. But if you give me 5 minutes, I'll need a half an hour. And the concept is, if a wife feels that if she really needs you, you're going to be there, she won't need you that much. That's the secret. You know, she has her things to do. She doesn't want to sit around and talk to you all day. You know, she has. You know, women are better friends for women anyway than men are. So, but she has to know. She has to know that when she needs you, you're going to be there for her, and you're not going to push her to the side. And if she knows that, she's secure, then she's not going to expect that you be involved in so many things. So that's key. That's part of what Shona Rishona is. That's part of all of these ideas. Yeah.
I want to know some of the reasons that Rambam gives for his principles of faith that say that the Torah that we got at Sinai is completely unchanged from the Torah that we have today.
Yeah, well, the basis of the Rambam's... Well, first of all, keep in mind, there's a certain historical context why the Rambam wrote those principles at that time and place. Because keep in mind that atheism wasn't a big deal in the Rambam's time. There weren't that many people who didn't believe in God. That's more of a modern problem. But the problem was there were many people who believed in Christianity or Islam. And what does Christianity say? Christianity does not deny revelation, meaning this whole issue, how do I know God gave the Torah at Sinai? That wasn't a Christian problem. They believed God gave the Torah at Sinai. But what did Christianity teach? Christianity taught, and Islam as well, that although God gave the Torah at Sinai, but he changed his mind because of the sins of the Jewish people, he decided to cancel his relationship with them and pick other people who are the followers of Yashka, Jews or Gentile, and the Torah has been abrogated. The whole argument of Christianity is not denying revelation, but it's claiming that the revelation can be superseded. Now, this is a very dangerous idea. In fact, to this very day, there are Jewish Christians who go along with that very, very idea. What is it called? Supersession, I think, is the technical term. That the revelation of Sinai has been superseded by a later revelation. Now, the Rambam had to combat that idea, and the Rambam's sources are basically from the oral law itself. None of his principles are made up. I mean, he may have formulated them as principles, but they are derived from the oral law. And the most important proof that the Rambam has is the statement that is in the Gemara in a number of places, that even a prophet of God has no power to change a commandment of the Torah. And even God himself cannot change a commandment of the Torah. If you remember, when God tried to intervene in a machlokas between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, the sages told HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lo bashamayim, the Torah is not in heaven, you cannot change this Torah either, and if you said the halacha is decided based on the majority, you cannot change and say follow the minority. So the Rambam extracted from the limitations on a prophet and from the rules called lo bashamayim that the prophecy of Moses, the Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu, is eternal and never changing. Now the reason that is so important is this is the most important reason why a Jew cannot be a Christian. Because there are other reasons too, you know, many reasons, but one of the reasons is because the essence of Christianity is the Torah has been replaced, and that could not be acceptable. Now, let me point out though that there are kashas on the Rambam's position, because what do you do with the Mamori Chazal that say, for example, all the Yomim Tovim are going to be replaced except for Purim. Does that not imply that when Mashiach comes, there won't be Rosh Hashanah, there won't be Pesach? Right? What do you say about that? And in fact, in the Gemara itself, there's a machlokes. Mitzvos betelos liyasid lava. Are the mitzvos going to be batel liyasid lava? The Gemara discusses this, for example. If you have a dead person, are you allowed to put tachrichim, shrouds, on a dead person that are shatnas, wool and linen? On one hand, he doesn't have the mitzvos anymore, so there's no aveira for a dead body to wear it. But there'll be tchias amesim, and maybe he'll be wearing shatnas when there's tchias amesim, so you can't put it on him. So the Gemara says this depends on whether the prohibition of shatnas will take effect after the resurrection. Now that implies that at least there's an opinion there will not be mitzvos later. How do you reconcile that? So the Maral says maybe there won't be mitzvos after resurrection because that's a totally new world. In other words, we have to differentiate between Mashiach, which is still in this world, and resurrection of the dead, which is a different stage. But be it as it may, the Rambam's klal itself is not so simple, but the Rambam felt this was the great defense that Judaism would have against Christianity and Islam. Yeah, did you want to follow up with that?
Yeah, sort of. Maybe I should try to reword my question.
Yeah.
How do we know that the sefers that Moshe handed to the 12 tribes have always been the same and have been the same until the Shabbos?
Oh, so you're simply asking how do we know that? Yeah. The simplest way that we know that as a logical proposition is the extremely small levels of discrepancies between the Sifrei Torah. Now, I still have to address why are there any discrepancies, but basically, every single Torah scroll that we've ever seen and ever had access to corresponds to each other with an exactitude factor of 99.999%. And unless you believe that this is of divine origin and it hasn't been changed, it would be impossible that there wouldn't be many, many more changes over thousands of years and over many, many geographical places. So the exactitude of a text to that type of accuracy level would seem to indicate a common origin, which then we assume comes from God now, or at least it's been preserved. Okay, remember, the Rambam is not proving revelation, but the Rambam is proving accuracy of the text. Now, the question you'll ask me is, well, okay, but 99.99 is not the same as 100, and there are some differences in Sifrei Torah. They're not big ones, but they do exist. Some words are spelt with an aleph, and some words in some Torahs, some words are spelt with a hey. Some Torahs have an extra vav here and there, which, by the way, puts the whole Bible codes thing into very serious question, because if you're based on exact letter counts, some have an extra letter, some don't. But the question is, how do you explain that? So, I once heard, and I'm really trying to find out where this is, I cannot find the written source of this, and that the idea was that even the differences in the Torah scrolls are from God. Because Moshe Rabbeinu, on the last day of his life, wrote 13 Sifrei Torah. That's a miracle. It's even Akasha. Moshe died on Shabbos. How could he write 13 Torah scrolls on Shabbos? So Tosva says that you're allowed to do Malacha Derech Neis, since obviously it was supernatural. It's amazing. It was supernatural. So the Torah doesn't prohibit miracles. If I could, you know, do some supernatural magic that would do writing, I'm allowed to do that, right? Supernatural writing. Now, Moshe, what happened? One Torah was put in the Aron HaKodesh, and Moshe gave one Torah to each Shevet. So it's been posited that every Shevet may have had a slightly different version of the Torah, because every Shevet had its own unique way of serving God, and we don't even know the significance of these differences, but the differences are not errors in transmission, but rather, there's the Reuven Torah, that's a tiny bit different than the Shimon Torah, and therefore, these differences are not mistakes or errors or corruptions. They themselves date back all the way. That's a very, very fascinating idea. I wish I could find the written Makor for that. But to go back to your basic question, the basic idea is that we have seen thousands and thousands of Sifrei Torah, and they are much more than 99% exactly the same, which wouldn't be possible unless you have the preservation of a divine document. That's the basic idea. Yeah.
You mentioned the Bible codes. I wanted to ask about that. I heard a shiur a few years ago about it. He was a Frum guy and he was a mathematician and he gave a lecture on it, and it seemed very convincing to me, and I heard it's not like legitimate today or people don't use it.
Well, you know, it's hard to say. You know, when I hear these types of presentations, and then I hear some other scientist who debunks it, you know, I frankly don't know who to believe. I hear one side saying there's a one in a trillion chance that this could happen, and the other person said, "Well, I did it with the New York Times, and I got the same result." Now, it's very hard for a lay person to be able to assess a machlokas among scientists.
Yeah.
You know. So I don't pay a lot of attention to it simply because, well, he says this, he says this. I don't know who's right. Now, the underlying concept that every single event that will ever happen in human history is alluded to in the Torah, we absolutely believe that is true. That is absolutely true. But whether this particular mechanism is the way to see that, that I think the jury is out. And I would not use it as an outreach tool, simply because I'm not in enough of a position to assess its credibility. But again, I absolutely believe that every future event is in the Torah. Now, people say the following problem. Here's the problem, and you know it's impossible. The problem is that all of the things they say the Torah predicts, we only discover after they happen. Meaning, we can now look at the Amalek Parsha and find Hitler's name there. Now, the problem is, if somebody would have been able to see Hitler's name before there was Hitler, and then Hitler comes, that would be very, very amazing. When you're finding things after the fact, you know, kind of, you almost know what you're looking for. That makes it a little less reliable. But the only problem is, until it happens, you don't know what you're looking for. I mean, how am I supposed to know that Hey Yud Tes Lamed Resh means anything? What am I looking for if I don't know there's a Hitler yet? So somebody said if only they could come up with a prediction that didn't happen yet, and then it happens, that would be, you know, 1,000% proof. But, you know, we can't do that. We only have hindsight. And once you're reading in predictions via hindsight, you have a problem. The other issue is, as I say, which I have not heard a great answer for, although I think I may have given you an answer, and that is, given the small differences in numbers of letters in Torah scrolls, that could throw off your encoding, because if you look at every seventh letter to spell out something, but depending on your letters, you know, what you think is the seventh may be the eighth. On the other hand, what I said is actually an answer to that, because according to what I said, every single Torah is from God. So as a result, if you see the message in one Torah, that's still going to be divine, because you're not dealing with the mistaken version. So that would actually be a potential answer to that issue. But I want to say as well that there was a fellow, I don't know if he's Jewish, and he's certainly secular, he identifies himself as an atheist, Michael Drosnin, who really, really, really was impressed with the Bible codes. It blew his mind, and he wrote a whole book showing it. But this created what you call cognitive dissonance, because on one hand, he was amazed that this is impossible for a human being to do. But at the same time, he didn't believe in God. So what do you do? So you would have thought, well, maybe this will make him believe in God. No, he didn't want to do that. So he posited there's like some super intelligent aliens from Mars or whatever it is, and they seeded the Earth with these futuristic predictions that were encoded in the text. So you see that people are so resistant to accept Hashem that they'd rather believe in aliens that have a future, that have time machines or whatever it is, than to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So if you don't want to be a Maimon, even the Bible codes are not gonna convince you.
Last week, the rabbi said something about, someone asked the rabbi about the Shimshon, and that he didn't do some things that were right.
Right.
And the rabbi said that we have a problem that every time we see a Gadol, like gadol ador, that he does something wrong, we say that he's not a gadol anymore.
Right.
So I want to ask the rabbi, what makes a gadol ador? If it's not his actions that make him, then what is it that makes him?
Well, no, it certainly is his actions. I mean, if a person is always doing averus, then by definition, he can't be a gadol. That's of course the case.
So Shimshon, why do we consider him?
Well, Shimshon had a few things, but you know, remember, Tanakh does not record every day of his life, right? Does not record maybe three things, right? So listen, if we went through our life and we only had three averos, we would be very, 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 very righteous, right? So in effect, Tanakh emphasizes the chesronos, but there was a whole life of righteousness and goodness and the like. So all I'm saying is that the fact that somebody sins and does tshuva, that does not disqualify them from being a gadol. In fact, the Gemara says in Kedushin, if you see a great person do an avera Monday, you have to assume he did tshuva by Monday night. In other words, by Monday night already, you're not supposed to assume that he's a rasha anymore. No, but you're right. I mean, nobody's saying if somebody is consistently doing sins over and over and over again, you know, he's not going to be the person that I consider to
who's
be a gadol.
Who's a gadol?
This is a very, very hard question. A gadol is someone that Klal Yisrael, meaning Jews who believe in Torah, I don't mean all Jews, you know, Jews who believe in Torah, consider to be, in other words, HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave Klal Yisrael almost a sixth sense as to who are the great people that are. It's like a magnetic thing. We can't even explain always. But it's a magnetic feeling of who is the person that can give, or who are the people that can give us guidance and hadracha. And usually it's because of their Torah knowledge, but also their midot and their avas Yisrael and their sense of care and concern for every Jew. And people feel that. People feel that. You feel that and you gravitate. And it may start off with only a few people doing it, but then the word spreads. You know, there was an interview with the New York Times in the 1970s. I don't know why he agreed to do this, but it was an interview with Rav Moshe Feinstein, I think on his 75th birthday. I don't know why. He sat down for a few minutes with the reporter. So the reporter said something like, I hear you're the greatest rabbi of the 20th century. How did you become so great? Or, you know, why do people consider you so great? So Rav Moshe, in his very, very modest way, said, you know, somebody asks you a shaila, you give an answer, and they like the answer, so they tell their neighbors, or someone else asks you a shaila. So after a while, he says, a lot of people just ask you shailas because, you know, there's word of mouth that spreads. So that's what Rav Moshe, that's how you become a gadol. But that's not really how you become a gadol. That's how you become maybe recognized as a gadol. You don't become a gadol by answering shailas. You become a gadol by learning Torah, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17 hours a day, Yomun Valayla, and doing chesed, that makes you a gadol, but it may take recognition. You know, Rebbe Yashiv, for many, many years, you know, I mean, Talmidei Chachamim always knew he was a great, great, great Talmid Chacham, but you know, for many years, he was an anonymous person. He was not like the world famous Rebbe Yashiv. People tell me, people who live in this neighborhood, Isaiah Bira, Beis Yisrael, that, you know, Rabbi Yashiv used to sit and learn, and they would have a shaila with meat and milk and nida, and they would just go to him and ask him. He was sitting in the basement. They would ask him. They were not like people around him and appointments that you had to make. And he was just a quiet person who sat for decades after decades, you know, sitting and learning Torah. Then he became, you know, the famous Gadol Hador. So many Gedolim have many, many years of just quiet. By the way, if Rebbe Yashiv would have a choice, he would have liked, he preferred that much more than what happened later. So if you want to learn, don't become a Gadol. You know, if you want to, don't become a Rosh Hashiva. If you want to learn, have uninterrupted learning, be a stockbroker or something, you know, because a Rosh Hashiva has to run a yeshiva, a Rosh Hashiva has to collect money, a Gadol is busy with all the problems of Klal Yisrael. Right, but as I say, the Meshech Chachma says Klal Yisrael is Margish, who are the Gedolim to connect themselves to. Yeah,
I was wondering if the Rav could give us a bit of insight what to do when it comes to claiming the death of Jesus, because if we go according to Chazal, that could lead to anti-Semitism if we according to the New Testament accounts. We can claim the Romans did it. What do we do? Do we claim it with pride, or do we sort of...
That's funny. Jews were fighting to get cleared of the death of Jesus, when in fact, according to Chazal, we did kill him as a Navi Sheker, as a false prophet who's high of Misa. I would counsel just being quiet. I don't think you need to claim pride. I think that might endanger Jews at this point. And if the church is willing to not blame us for it, then I don't think we need to blame. But even though it's true, but as I say, it's not. We live in a world, as the Gemara says, that you don't try to incite the Goyim or the Gentiles to hate the Jewish people. So I would just keep it under your shirt. Yeah.
You mentioned a few weeks ago, I think that Robert told me about how much you have to do shtadlus, how much you should work according to your muna, when you have the muna and the kodesh bochu, that you provide for your panas and you learn the whole day, then it's okay, and it's depending on your muna. But how do you know from yourself that you are allowed to learn the whole day and not to work and to learn if you have high levels of Muna to do this?
Well, how do you know? I mean, part of how you know is you actually try it as an experiment. I mean, meaning to say, you live this way for a while, because everybody could do it for a while, and you see, are you able to make ends meet? Do you have fears? Are you afraid? Are you worried? Are you concerned? Are you anxious? Because if a person is anxious by living this way, that's a little bit of a sign that they're not on that madrega of emuna. If, on the other hand, you're serene, that even if all you have is bread in the house, say Baruch Hashem. In other words, a lot of it depends on your attitude. Now, I know what I just said raises another question. That's, well, wait a second. But aren't we supposed to change our midos? In other words, if I'm anxious because I don't have emuna, so instead of saying go to work, shouldn't we say work on your emuna? To a degree, that's absolutely the case. We all have to work on our emuna. But we also have to work within the limits of our midos. And that is, you can't necessarily be ready to live on a madrega that is beyond you. And if you try to live on a madrega that's much higher than you, it's going to destroy you. So in many, many ways, you have to gauge your daigas, your worries, and you have to respond to them. Let me give you an analogy. It has nothing to do with this, but it's a similar analogy. People often ask the question, if you're dating, how important is physical attraction? How important is looks? Let's say the woman can say on the man as well, perfect midos. Tzadekes, a Yireh Shamayim, a wonderful person, a Balas Chesed, but I don't like the way she looks. Is that important? Now, I can sit here and tell you, of course it's not important. Would the Chavetz Chaim care about that? He says, why is that important? But here is the point. If we're not on that madrega, and it's something that bothers us, then even if it shouldn't bother us in some objective sense, if it bothers you, you can't pretend it doesn't bother you. It's going to affect the way you look at your wife. It's going to affect the way you look at other women after you're married. It's going to hurt her because she's going to sense you don't find her attractive. It may result in a bitul of ayna and peri of arivia. So it's important in trying to be a tzaddik not to be a tzaddik in a madrega that is beyond your capacity at that point. So I could tell you in theory, it's not important. How could you possibly think of that? But if it really bothers you, you cannot ignore it. This is an important lesson in Avodah. The Gemara in Chulin says that a certain rabbi said, I am nothing compared to my father. I'm like vinegar compared to wine. When I eat fleishiks, I don't eat milchiks for 6 hours. But when my father ate fleishiks, he would not have milk for 24 hours. He's admiring his father's mesiras nefesh. Now the question is, if he thought it was such a good thing not to have milchik for 24 hours, then he could have done it. What, he had to have Ben and Jerry's? In other words, let him do it. The answer is, what he's saying is, I could do it, But my father did it because he had such yiras shamayim that chas v'shalom, a piece of meat would be in his mouth and touch the milk. And his yiras shamayim made him do it. He says, I don't have that yiras shamayim. I frankly, I'm not so worried about that. Elamai, I could do it anyway, but for me it would be a fake. For me it would just be an external action. It would be a chitzonius. It wouldn't be a panemius. It's not that he's saying he couldn't do it, but he's saying it wouldn't be reflective of my madrega. You know, there are two psukim in Koheles. Al tihi tzadik harbe, do not be too much of a tzadik. Al tihi rasha harbe, do not be too much of a rasha. Now we understand, do not be too much of a rasha, that's, you know, that's pretty simple. Don't be too much of a rasha. But what does it mean not to be too much of a tzadik? How can you be too much of a tzadik? Too much of a good thing? How could that be? The answer is, when you try to live at a madrega externally, that you have not attained internally, the tension is going to drive you crazy, and you will lose even the madregas that you attained internally. And that's why you have to be careful. That's why we always say the process of tshuva is a gradual movement, not to take on too much, too fast, because it can be very, very destructive. You try to soar, you wind up crashing. You hit the wall and you fall down. But it's a difficult balance, because on the other hand, you're supposed to challenge yourself. You see, again, all of these things are a bit contradictory. You're supposed to challenge, you're supposed to go beyond your comfort level, you're supposed to do a little bit more, but you got to do it a little bit more in a gradual way. You know, you don't say, for example, I'm going to learn, you know, 18 hours a day, and then don't sleep and don't eat. It's going to hurt your health, and then, you know, you're not going to be able to learn at all for a while, right? So this is a very, very difficult shikul, and this goes to the idea of emuna as well. You have to work according to your madrega at the time. You can't radically change yourself unless inside you've achieved a certain madrega. Okay, any more for tonight? Yeah.
I was wondering if there's anything wrong with during tefillah asking Hashem for something and saying, Hashem, if you do this for me, I'll do this. I know ideally it's probably better to say, I'm going to do this, and please give me this.
Yeah.
But if there's anything inherently wrong with saying what I said before, if you do this for me, I'll do this.
Well, remember, this is exactly what Yaakov Avinu said. Remember, Yaakov Avinu is running away from Esav, and he's going to Lavan's house. And remember, he has the dream at night. That's when he daven Maariv, and he has the dream of the ladder of the angels going up and down. And Hashem promised Yaakov, I'll protect you. What did Yaakov say? Yaakov said, if you bring me back to Eretz Yisrael safely and you give me food to eat and clothing to wear, then I will give 10% of my... So Yaakov Avinu did it. You certainly can do it. The only thing I would urge you to do is do not say it as a vow. Say, Beli Neder. Because when you make a vow, if Chas V'Shalom were not able to keep the Neder, it's a very, very big avera. It's better not to make a Neder than to make a Neder and not keep it. So that's the only condition I would put in that. But what you're doing is exactly what Yaakov Avinu did. And that is permitted. You know, that is permitted. It's permitted to... In fact, I'll tell you a very interesting story. All of you are familiar with the Sefer Pnei Yehoshua, right? Pnei Yehoshua. Pnei Yehoshua is one of the great, great Achronim, early Achronim on Shas. And by the way, the Pnei Yehoshua does a lot of things, but one of the main things he does is he tries to answer all of Tosos's kashas on Rashi. He's a great defender of Rashi. When Tosos asks all the kashas on Rashi, Pnei Yehoshua tries to give an answer. By the way, it is recorded that before the Pnei Yehoshua wrote his Sefer, he decided he wanted to review Shas 36 times in a row. In preparation for the Sefer, Pnei Yehoshua, I mean, he had learned Shas probably hundreds of times, but right before the Sefer, let's do a Chazara 36 times of Shas. So when he writes the Pnei Yehoshua and Brachos, he already knows the Gemara and Nida and, you know, everything else, that the whole Talmud was in his mind. But if you look in the Hakdama, you see why he wrote the Pnei Yehoshua. Fascinating story. I mean, tragic story. He was in a courtyard with a lot of buildings. A wooden courtyard in Germany. He's from Frankfurt. And the buildings caught fire. And people were caught. They were trapped inside buildings. Beams were falling down and the roofs were collapsing. And hundreds of people were dying in the fire. and the Pnei Yeshua was trapped in a building and he had no escape, and he said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, if you will give me a Yeshua and give me life, I will dedicate the rest of my life to exploring your Torah and writing Chidushei Torah that will defend the greatness of Rashi. He said exactly that. And then what happened was, all of a sudden there was like a beam like fell out of the way and opened up a way that he could, a narrow opening, that he escaped back into the street. So the Pnei Yeshua, we got to save Pnei Yeshua because he exactly made that type of promise to our Kodesh Baruch Hu. It's in the Hakdam of the Pnei Yeshua. Like, I believe he then says that every year his family made a celebration. This is called a family Purim. This was such a minhag, it's brought down, that if the day that a nace happened to you, your family for generations would make that day like a Purim celebration to thank Hashem for the miracle. We have a number of family Purims like that that are recorded. So I think Pnei Yeshua made that day like a Purim takana for his family. Okay, you all have a good day. We'll see you tomorrow.